Is that, are we done?
Yes.
It is linoleum.
It is. It is that thing.
That was Alonzo's choice of opening theme music this week.
It was that thing.
And it just stopped the motor of the world.
Oh, stop.
You chose that, and I'm going to guess. Here's why you chose that. Mm-hmm. You chose that because last night, as we were driving to the Outfest Legacy Awards, mm-hmm. because you're a greeter at Outfest. Is
yeah,
that right?
Like at Walmart. Exactly, yeah.
And I was thinking more of like at the Gap. They used to have greeters at the Gap. I'm like, right. I don't know that they do
that
anymore.
They might, yeah.
Your iPod was really kicking the old school 90s gay dance club jams. Lonnie Gordon happening all over again. And Crystal Waters, something or other last night.
Was there a Crystal Waters last
night? I think
night?
So.
No, I really just put this on too because I figured it would annoy you. and also because I like her.
It doesn't annoy me, really.
I like
Crystal Waters.
Song.
Here's what, I like the dance singer ladies that can't sing. I lament the onset of auto-tune in making everyone able
to
sing.
Where are the ultra nate?
Where? What
tomorrow?
Happened? You know what happened to ultra nate?
No, I do not.
She started being able to sing.
Oh, and that ruined everything.
And that just ruined everything. I remember back in the day, it was like 1990, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I heard, I worked in a record shop
yes.
in 1990. And we had a full-time DJ who worked in the store also. And the dance records would come in every Friday. And he would spend all Friday afternoon spinning and
on the wheels of steel.
Yes, and he would, you know, be testing out the records to see what, you know, he wanted to use. And he worked in the shop, but he was also a DJ after that, outside the shop. And I remember the first Ultra Nate record came in the store, and I can't remember now the title of it. No, I do remember the title of it. It's Over Now. The song is 27 minutes long. But this is how she said.
So it's
Ultra
an ironic
Nate.
Title.
Yeah, she used to sing this song. It would be just like. I mean, this is the quality. Like, she'd been drinking NyQuil. I love that. I don't want to hear perfection. I want to hear a woman who has been up all night.
Who sings that Arthur Russell?
Oh, is it all over my face?
Yes.
She was at the documentary that night.
Yeah,
the Arthur Russell documentary.
At
the
Outfest,
woman,
yeah.
And I'm blanking on her name.
Yeah, because that's some,
is it all over my face?
That is some can't sing singing right there.
Yeah, I love a can't sing singer.
Yeah,
that's that. I don't care how well. This is why American Idol and The Voice are stupid, because they focus on people who can sing.
Boring.
They should focus on people who are great performers.
Yes.
Interpreters of songs.
Who's singing,
Billie Holiday would lose.
Whose singing is beside the point.
Billie Holiday would lose
well,
on a
yeah,
show like
yeah,
this.
I mean, Dylan would not get far
yeah.
on Idol either. Yeah.
So, anyway, Crystal
Actually,
Waters.
Part of why I picked it was because yeah. it's from the Red Hot and Rio compilation.
Yeah.
And today is AIDS Walk LA.
I know, they woke me up. No, I mean, they didn't wake me up. But when I was awake early this morning, I heard all their noises.
Because
they're like 6 blocks away, but, you know, they've got megaphones
right.
and things. And
they
so
cause such a clatter.
Because AIDS is noisy. and so they're going
to... AIDS walks anyway.
They're going to wake you up with it.
We should mention that you're Dave White,
I'm,
film critic for movies.com.
I'm... I am Dave, Directive 10289 White.
You've now made 2 references to a movie that no one saw this
You
weekend.
Are Alonzo. I'm sorry, wait a second. Your name is Alonzo. Trading for Goods and Services, Duralde.
Thank you.
Just
yes.
because no one went to see this movie this weekend doesn't mean everyone shouldn't
well,
see
Well, we're
going to
be talking about it for sure.
We're going to talk about it right now.
Oh, really? Okay.
We're going to kick it off.
Right. All right.
We're going to kick it off. Because you know what? Who cares about Argo? It's successful.
Yes. It's good. And you know
it's
good. It's
a good singer.
There you go. We'll get to why it's good. But yeah. Okay, fine. We'll start with Atlas Shrugged Part 2, Was it The Strike? Is that what they're
still shrugging?
You know, that's a better title. Yes, yeah. But I think it's the, I think on the on-screen.
I kind of stole that from 30 Rock. I mean, they didn't make an Atlas Shrugged joke, but they made a joke about the help.
Oh, still helping.
Still helping. The help too. We went to see Atlas Shrugged Part 2.
Yes.
The Strike.
Right.
Friday morning. With a very rambunctious audience. It wasn't a huge audience. If you recall last year when Atlas Shrugged Part Uno came out.
Well, yeah, we saw it on Libertarian Date Night.
Yeah, we saw it on opening weekend at the one theater that they were screening it at in the city.
Right.
And we felt lucky that we didn't have to drive to Long Beach.
Yeah.
Because that's usually, the right-wing movies usually open out at,
way out
closest
the
to us generally is Burbank.
Yeah. If we're lucky, but which is not
far away.
Usually
at all.
It's the trek to Orange County.
Yeah, but Atlas Shrugged Part Two has opened fairly widely.
Yeah, we had like three or four theaters we could go into that were close to us.
So we go to the Century City, and it's like 10 o'clock in the morning, and the audience for this movie, they were talking amongst themselves, talking back to the screen.
Some people were laughing at it with us, and then some people were like cheering the big speeches, and you know,
were they?
I caught a few people though that seemed to be snickering.
Well, here's the thing. I think you can really be on board for this movie and still snicker because they're not well-made films.
No. You can. I think there are fans of Ayn Rand who still look at these movies and are kind of embarrassed at how cheap and corny they are.
If you're a fan of Ayn Rand and you actually believe the things that Ayn Rand says about excellence, then you should really be anti these films. And because I've seen like half the movies this week, I've seen about twice the number of movies this week that you have.
Uh-huh.
You're going to explain what this is about.
Okay. All right. So as you'll no doubt recall from the last from our last exciting episode.
Yes.
Dagny Taggart is running a railroad, which in this sort of future dystopia America is sort of like the last big industry that's connecting the country. Like gas is $40 a gallon.
It costs $800 to fill up your truck.
Yeah. So like,
That's a great moment in the film.
No one's flying.
The guy's got a shotgun and he's like making sure she doesn't run off.
Yeah. The gas station, like the numbers go by really fast. That's one of the few funny moments or intentionally funny moments. And she is having an affair with Henry Reardon, who is this steel magnate who has created a new, lighter, stronger metal called Reardon metal. But the society is falling apart because the government is choking innovation and punishing the wealthy and the successful. And a lot of today's the society's best and brightest are mysteriously disappearing, and where are they going, and why have they gone away, and who is John Galt is what everybody keeps asking when there's an insurmountable question. And so in this episode, we have a whole new cast. They fired everybody and like started.
Did they fire or did everyone refuse to come back? Part
two? I don't know. I would be shocked that everybody refused. I think this seems like a conscious decision to start over. So everybody that you forget all the faces you learned in the first movie, they're all gone. So now Samantha Mathis is playing the lead instead of Taylor Schilling. And I don't know who was playing Henry Reardon last time, but now it's Jason Begg. And, there's an interesting cast of solid, like, C-level character actors here. And Teller of Penn & Teller, who talks.
He talks.
For, like, a whole two sentences. Anyway, so the whole movie is Dagny running around trying to figure out who invented this great motor. She thinks that John Galt may have done it, and
she gets Jethro from the Beverly Hillbillies movie to come in and science it.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And then the awesome people keep disappearing, and the government keeps making
things. And here's I would like you to explain to me.
Including a composer.
Including a composer. Now here's my questions.
Shoot.
You've read this book.
Yeah.
I've not read this book. But, I might do that someday. Just because it's now that I've seen parts one and two of this movie,
a crackpot page.
I'm getting increasingly fascinated with it. And so, in the mind of Ayn Rand,
mm-hmm.
are artists the same level of producer as, you know, great engineers and great business people.
There are artists who are of value, but again, it's through her standards of, you know, are they iconoclasts and do they stand on their own and refuse to compromise? And, you know, are they not mediocre and or, you know, bending towards the will of the sheep public? You know, that sort of thing.
But if they are the iconoclasts that are not bending toward the will of the sheep public, this composer in the movie who goes like in A Boy Named Charlie Brown, he's got a big audience. Like he sold out a big music hall,
right?
So he's popular.
Well, success isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's all just about like not about, you know, following your own.
Yeah, but in real life, it's Matchbox 20 that sells out. You know what I mean?
Nickelback. I am not the person. I'm not the person to explain what Ayn Rand.
Kesha.
I just know that in the book there are artists that she, you know, there are characters in the book who are artists who she treats with as much seriousness as she does the industrial.
And so these are these artists of the same mindset as the great business tycoons and titans and the people? Because
yes.
I get confused.
I see where you're going here. Yeah.
Because artists, as any right-wing person will tell you, generally tend to be lefty, communist, homosexual.
Unless they're Chuck Norris.
Parasites. Unless...
Or they're Chuck Thomas Norris, Kincaid.
Or, yeah. And when this guy disappears,
or
Stacey Dash, yes. When this guy disappears, he rips up his
cantata
compositions, his great works. He rips them up, and nobody gets to hear his music anymore. I'll show you. Now, who besides Metallica is that dickish about their music?
This guy.
This is what I don't understand.
Well, look, you watch The Fountainhead with me, right?
That's a great movie.
Remember the beginning of the movie when not Dagny, whatever her name is, the same woman, you know, the Patricia Neal, throws the statue down the air vent because it was too perfect to live or something?
I love that.
Yeah, I can't begin to explain how art works into this whole world. But anyway, yeah, so that guy disappears too.
Well, I think it's... honestly, this story has now captivated me. I'm so into this, how this is going to all end now. I know nobody went to see this movie this weekend, although the box office has been pretty bad for it.
Yeah.
Because it's not a good movie. I mean, it's better than the last one.
It is a step up from the last one.
The first one was made for like 35 cents.
Yeah, this one was made for like $2.50.
Yeah, and there's more money on the screen. You can see the things.
Yeah.
The digital effects are still hilarious.
Oh, like, God.
When she flies the plane.
There's a mine explosion.
The flying scenes in this movie were better done on, like, Airwolf, the TV show. Like, there's no credibility in terms of, like, oh, I really do believe that she is now flying a plane, or that mine just exploded, or... Those
trains collided.
Nothing looks real or good, but it's such a fascinating story about people just announcing things to each other.
Yeah, there's so much declaiming in these movies, and it almost the entire movie boils down to either people sort of like declaring their point of view of the world and how it should work, or two characters exchanging information that they already know, just so we are kept up to speed of what's going on.
Everything is just exposition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating is the people who take this stuff so seriously, like what it says about them when you watch something that's this, like, you know, so...
But what if it were really well made? What if it were really well made?
Would it be more convincing?
I think it might be. It were better written.
It would be more convincing if you had, like you know, originally this was going to be like Angelica Houston. Angelina Jolie wanted to play Dagny Taggart for a long time.
Wouldn't that have been interesting
if you had gotten, like, actual stars to do it, then, yeah, it would maybe be more convincing. But it would still come down to this whole crazy, like, the earners and the takers and the parasites and the blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And, you know, ultimately it all comes down to, like, the government needs to, like, not tax anyone and not tell anyone what to do ever, you know. And it's like, thanks for the lead paint, you know. I'm sorry, you know, I I've made the joke before. The real ending of Atlas Shrugged was 1980 to the present. You know, that's what right. actually happens when you yeah. let this stuff happen. You know, the titans of business are not these like these great, you know, visionaries who need to run unfettered. I mean, yeah, maybe some of them are, but for the most part, you know, they will undercut everything and you know, destroy everyone and everything to make money.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, to be a visionary means that you want to make, on some level, you want to make the world better.
Yeah.
And to make the world better means that it's going to benefit other people. And that seems to clash with another basic tenet of this philosophy.
Well, no, she seems to think that if the world is made better by the efforts of a few who have been allowed to do what they want to do, that's fine, because it gives people the opportunity to work and to be part of things that are better. Yeah. It's charity and altruism that she right. thinks is a bad thing, because if you just give stuff to people, then they'll never work for it themselves, and they'll be lazy, and they'll just be parasites.
Well, you are. I mean, you're a parasite. Mm-hmm. Like, I cook and clean this whole house, and uh-huh. you just lie around.
Yeah.
Doing nothing.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess really, I'm the Dagny Taggart and the Reardon Metal of this home and this podcast. And you are, you have a looter's mentality. You just take and take.
You're insane.
I think that's what really, I think we've just both learned something right now.
I give and give and give. So, yeah, it's...
One of my favorite moments comes after they institute Directive 10-289.
Right.
And they take Reardon away from...
They take the medal away from Reardon.
Yeah.
With the most ridiculous...
The government takes it.
The government takes it away.
With a courtroom scene that is really wonderful.
Well... okay, because there's also the moment where they finally beat him by threatening to reveal
his affair with Dagny,
because that yeah. would destroy her. It's like,
yeah.
okay, maybe in 1957 when this book came out, right. but now, especially in the future, who cares?
She'd be like, yeah, I'm doing him,
yeah, whatever.
Yeah. I'm talking about
the big courtroom scene. Of, like, who are the people?
The Maury Povich audience.
Yeah, Maury Povich audience that shows up for the, you know, the trial of this, you know, industrialist. Like, okay, yeah, you've got nothing better to do
than... stand up and cheer. They do everything except go, ooh, 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 you know, like the fist pump, like the Arsenio
right.
thing.
No one's holding signs, you know,
yeah.
in the John 3:16 or something.
but I really, you know what, go see this movie, because it's just...
it's terrible,
it's
but it's
not good, but it's...
Go with the right people, and go to in a theater where you can, like, make comments to each other without getting beaten up by some Tea Party.
I want part three, and I said this in my review, I want part three to be an objectivist Inception. I want... because at the end, you find out where they've all gone.
Right.
They've all gone into this sort of ultra dimension. Another ultra.
No, it's not an ultra dimension.
It's another world of some sort. It's through a cabin in the woods sort of screen.
It's a cloaking device.
Right. That's magical other world stuff.
No, it's science.
Oh, I see.
From these great geniuses who were driven out of society.
They don't tell you that.
The government choked
them. They don't tell you it's future science. They play it out like it's magic. I have not read this book. What I have seen in this film is that they have entered a magical dimension.
Well, even in Cabin in the Woods, it's not another dimension. It's just it's a barrier.
It's a barrier between this world and another world.
No.
Yes.
No.
So anyway, no, that's true.
If it were a barrier between the one world and the other, then how come driving through the tunnel keeps you in the same world?
Maybe I have to go see Cabin in the Woods again.
Maybe you do. Maybe you do.
Look, I'm saying that in this movie...
they're in Colorado.
The boundaries are not clear.
Well, a lot of things are not clear in this movie.
And so it's this other place. It's a secret place, yeah. whether it's imaginary or magical or real and created by future science. It's another place. And that other place looks kind of crazy, and I want to see it in all of its Narnia of the right wing glory.
You will, part three. You will get that in part three.
I want amazing production values. I want a big budget.
That you're not gonna
I want these awesome producers to to go get that money. Make this movie right.
Well, apparently...
Convince me. By the end of part three, I need to be out there reading The Virtue of Selfishness. Voluntarily.
Part of the reason that number one was so janky, apparently, was that... it was literally one of those deals where, like, we have to start shooting in 30 days or we lose the rights to the material. And so they did. and so I think this one they maybe had a little more prep time.
Efficiency.
Exactly.
There's a Sean Hannity cameo in this
movie. There is a Sean Hannity cameo in this movie, which should tell you everything you need to know about Atlas Shrugged Part 2.
So I saw Here Comes the Boom.
Boom!
And again, apparently nobody's going to see Here Comes the Boom.
Not so much, no.
Because...
Who knows what that movie is about? The title doesn't tell you. The ads don't tell you.
By the title, you would think that it was a biopic of the Christian nu metal band POD.
I don't get it.
That's because they're the ones who performed the song.
Oh, that's a song? Here Comes the
Boom. Yeah, it's a, oh. It's a, it was a, it was a hit.
It was a hit.
Yeah.
I see.
I mean, not a good hit, but it was
a hit nonetheless.
Right. Remember last year when Warrior came out?
I do.
And no one saw it?
I do.
I think what we were learning now is that no one wants to see movies about mixed martial arts.
Apparently not.
Which is sad, you know, because mixed martial arts is a lot of fun. It is fun to watch. People are really, really being hurt. And violence, especially real violence, is great entertainment. And so...
And do we believe that Kevin James can actually do, like...
Well, that's the joke of the movie.
Karate kicks.
The joke is that, you know, this... The joke is that the man whose headshot is in the Rochester Big and Tall in Beverly Hills...
Right.
And I'm not making that up because... Nope. I've been there.
Right there with the bowl of Hershey's Kisses.
Right. Yeah. Not far away from the counter where they have a bowl of Hershey's Kisses.
It's like when Mr. Pinky in Hairspray is passing donuts around the Hefty Hideaway.
Yes. The joke is that, you know, he was a high school wrestler.
Uh-huh.
And at various points in the movie, people just tell him, "Wow, you're so solid." And I'm like, does that mean I'm solid too? Like, I shake when I laugh like a bowl full of jelly. Is that the same thing? You know? He's a teacher, not a good one. Or he used to be a good one like Viola Davis and Won't Back Down.
Oh, I see.
Another movie nobody went to see.
Now he's phoning it in.
But now he's phoning it in. And the school's going to lose their music department. Henry Winkler is the music teacher.
Oh, and Mr. Holland.
The orchestra is going to be cut because the budget cuts.
Yes.
And the bad guy, the principal, doesn't want to hear it.
It's Atlas Shrugged's fault that they're cutting the budget for the... Yes.
And so he decides he's going to go earn money being a mixed martial arts fighter so he can raise the $48,000 it costs to keep... the music program in the school. So he's going to go out and
what is his connection to the music program?
He just really likes the music teacher, Henry Winkler. They're buddies.
Okay.
Yeah. And he feels bad. Mm-hmm. He's an upstanding guy.
I see.
Kevin James is a good guy. He's not he's a bored teacher, but he's a good man.
Right.
And which is great. That's great casting because Kevin James, his function in the media is to be a good guy, a guy that you like and that you root for and that you can insert your own, like you can transfer all your stuff onto him because
he's the one fat guy the movies are allowed to have.
He's a schlub and you know, if he's going to go sacrifice, you know, X amount of whatever for the school, then you could kind of see yourself doing that too.
Mm-hmm.
You could see yourself being sort of heroic on that medium scale. Also, if he gets to date Salma Hayek in the movie, you can see yourself with a foxy babe like her.
Right.
And she's, you know, he asks her out so many times that in real life, HR would be involved. But she just is like, oh, you're so funny. You know, like, so it's a cute little nothing asexual person that I am ignoring.
Also, I am married to
a until he takes off that shirt. Starts fighting, and she's all, check him out.
the pheromones start flying.
That's right.
Okay.
He works up a musk. So he fights, and his whole thing is like, as long as he can keep in the ring and lose, he can still earn money.
Ah.
Because you get paid even if you lose.
Right.
And his goal is to work himself all the way up to lose against someone big for a big chunk.
Gotcha.
And, you know, things happen. I won't spoil the
movie. Oh, you know, because everyone's dying to run out to see Here Comes the Boom.
I won't spoil it for you. But here's the thing. This movie is actually quite sweet and quite silly in the idea that you would save a music program in a high school by, you know, committing sort of brutal violence.
Getting the tar walloped out of you.
Yeah, it was done to dramatic effect in Warrior, where this man was gonna lose his home.
Right.
And his family was gonna be out on the street. And then they heightened it by him making him realize that he was going to have to fight his own brother,
right,
from whom he was deeply estranged. And
the brother is in turn fighting to raise money for his war buddy who died.
Yeah, like there's
widow and child.
The stakes are so high in Warrior, and so agonizing about like the family bonds and the who gets the money if things, you know, who loses and doesn't get what they need.
Whereas this is about, can we still afford the cello?
Can we? Yeah, it was equally important.
No,
in many ways,
arts and music in the schools are very important. It's a little tough to make a linchpin for a movie.
It's not a great movie, but it is perfectly amiable, and again, it's good-hearted and funny enough.
Which Happy Madison hack directed it?
I don't remember. You're happy to see Kevin James do the things he does the best, and what he does best is be the King of Queens, and that's what he's doing here. He's the King of Queens as a biology teacher.
Okay.
And that cute little Charisse is in it.
Oh, yeah.
From who's on Glee sometimes.
Right, right. She's
the Oprah prodigy.
Yes.
She sings a Neil Diamond song at the big match. Because that's what happens.
Sure, of course.
And there's something in this movie called Disco Street Fighting that takes place as well. That's fascinating.
Tell me more.
It's. I don't think it's a real class. Oh. I think it's a joke.
Oh.
I know you can't go. I know.
All the good things are fake.
You miss aerobics. I know you do. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to look up on the internet some local churches that still have believer-sized classes.
Look, we're going to get...
They're probably going to be free.
We're going to get that Step Up Revolution workout DVD. And then just you wait.
This is like a family... This is like a family-friendly Disney sitcom version of Warrior.
Okay.
With little trickles of blood, because it's PG.
Right, yeah. Right, right.
It's not R-rated. Like, Warrior's rated R, and...
Yeah.
Violent and had the F word.
Speaking of
people are really unhappy in Warrior. No one's really unhappy in Here Comes the Boom.
Sure not.
And you will not be really unhappy if you see it. I mean, it's not the end of the world. It's certainly not worth getting worked up over.
All right.
Yeah.
It's inoffensive.
Yeah.
Speaking of people who are on Glee who sing, last night at the Outfest Legacy Awards, we saw Darren Criss do a surprising number from How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. The honorees at last night's thing were producers Craig Zaden and Neil Marin, who did the Broadway revival, and Darren Criss.
Why are you talking about this?
Because you mentioned Charisse and Glee, and it just reminded me. It's a fun story.
Okay. Keep telling it.
Anyway, so he's...
Why don't you keep telling it?
So he's saying Happy to Keep His Dinner Warm, which is a song that the female lead of the show usually sings.
I learned this after the fact.
Right, I had to explain it to you. And so it was kind of cool to hear him do it since he had played the male lead of the show.
I will contribute to this story.
Do.
He can...
Cut it live.
Cut it live, yeah. Yes. He can sing.
Well, he's been on Broadway.
Yeah, well.
And that beardy glasses guy who always plays the piano on Glee played the piano, so that was kind of cool, too.
You pointed that out to me.
Yes. So forgive me for digressing.
I'm glad that
from
story.
Here comes the boom.
I'm glad we learned about that.
Thank you for telling us about that. You know, it's such an important movie. I don't know why I would detract from it for a second.
So in Sinister,
you're doing all the movies that you saw that I didn't. Fine.
Ethan Hawke is a true crime writer,
right?
And he moves. He's very method. He's the method actor of true crime writers. He moves his family. At the beginning of the movie, the wife goes, "You're not moving this into a house a block away from a crime scene, are you?" And he's like, "No." She's like, "Good, because I don't want to know." Well, he moved them into the crime scene.
Yeah, that's great.
He moved them into a murder house to end all murder houses. The opening credits, and you've seen this if you've seen the trailer for the movie, the opening credits show a family of four people being hanged from the branch of a tree in slow motion, all simultaneously. Like, they're all on one rope somehow. And they're all kicking until they die. And then the opening credits are this scene. And it, all you see on the screen is the word Sinister. That's it. That's all the opening credits when we go into the movie. He moves them into this murder house where the branch of the tree is still broken and hanging, barely half connected to the tree. Like, the crime scene people didn't just sort of like, "Let's clean this up." Like,
the wind didn't knock it over.
Nothing. Yeah, it's still there. And so, in the attic of the new home, he finds a box of old Super 8 home movies. And he's, locks himself in his office and he hooks up the projector and he starts watching them. And each one of these movies has an innocuous title, like Backyard Pool Party and, Family Trip in the Car and stuff like that. But in reality, what it is a family being bound and gagged and shoved in their car and the car set on fire and exploded. And then another family being bound and gagged to pool furniture and dragged into the pool to drown.
My question is, who's developing these films?
I'm glad you asked. A supernatural entity, a pagan deity named Bagul. Bagul. Bagul.
Okay.
He looks like every guy in Emperor and Immortal and, Mayhem and
these are black metal Dark bands, Throne. Incidentally.
He looks like Mortis,
which I only know
without
because I
the
live
funny
with
ears.
You.
Like, and so there's a moment. This is very funny. There's a moment in the movie where Vincent D'Onofrio is a local expert on the occult, a professor at a university,
of course,
because that's all they have time to do is like that and the Robert De Niro
and debunk spoonbenders.
Yeah.
Yes. Red lights,
yeah, that movie. The only thing that he does in this film is sit on a Skype and Skype with Ethan Hawke. Like, you've heard of phoned-in performances. This is literally a Skyped-in performance. But at one point he says, "Now, we're not talking about just a Norwegian black metal band here, the people doing something to piss off the Christians." And I was like, no, this is actually kind of what we're talking about here. This guy looks like he's in a black metal band, this supernatural, being, this monster guy. Who is a creature that devours the souls of children. Or sometimes just devours children. And that's Vincent D'Onofrio goes sometimes says at one point, and sometimes instead of devouring the souls, he just will devour a child.
Depends,
sometimes it depends on what you're in the mood for.
Sometimes you feel like a soul, sometimes you don't.
And Ethan Hawke, things start happening in the house. Of course.
You don't say.
Supernatural things begin happening in the house. And everyone's like, "What's going on in the house?" And Ethan Hawke's like, "I don't know. Leave me alone. I'm trying to work." He does nothing to try to help his family. And I'm making it sound like a
somewhere,
bad movie.
Somewhere Uma Thurman is nodding sagely.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm not going to spoil this film because the point of a horror movie is not to know where it's going. But if you love horror movies, you know where it's going. They're doomed, obviously. And the fun is watching how they get there. A friend saw it this past weekend, and he sort of angrily came back to me and said, "How can you recommend this movie?" I said, "Hey, man, I like this movie." And he's like, "Yeah, but it doesn't make any sense. Nothing makes logical sense. Nothing that any human character does in this movie makes sense." Like, and I said, "Okay, but hold up right there. Because by applying real-life person's logic, by a person who does not live in a murder home possessed by a supernatural being, you're pulling the rug out from under the movie. The movie isn't about this is all going to make perfect logical sense. Supernatural things never do because there's no such thing." And so hang on. The ride is about being unsettled and disturbed and frightened. And the movie's good at that. Even though what Ethan Hawke and the other human people in this movie are doing is not helping them, and it doesn't make any rational sense, you know, for them to behave in any other way.
That's a cop out, though.
No, I don't think it is.
I haven't seen this movie, but I mean, like, if you look at The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby, like those characters behave the way logical, rational human beings would behave, and still,
yes, and those are great movies. Okay,
I'm just saying introducing a supernatural element doesn't let you off the hook to write.
I understand that.
Okay,
I'm telling you. I'm not telling you that this is The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby. I'm telling you that this is Sinister. And it is perfectly acceptable silliness-based horror.
Mm.
Okay? The home movies that he watches are especially gruesome and genuinely frightening. There were a few moments in the home movie scenes of people being killed that made me go, you know, like that startled me and frightened me. That doesn't often happen to me in films like this.
I have never seen that happen.
It's not a great movie, but it's pretty good. You know, it's like it's effective at making you feel grossed out and creeped out and disturbed and unsettled. If you are hoping that it is, you know, a horror film on the level of The Exorcist, you will be very disappointed. Because, yes, the people do not behave rationally. And I don't think a horror movie, a regular run-of-the-mill, middling, that was good enough kind of horror movie, I don't think it has to, you know, hit all those marks.
All right.
It would be nice if it did.
Right.
I'm not making excuses for the movie. I see what the movie for what it is. It's not.
But you're
great,
okay with it.
But I'm okay with it because there's enough actual frightening, unsettling stuff in the movie to carry you along.
Right.
And if you get hung up on the hey, he wouldn't do that. Hey, why doesn't anyone ever turn on a light when they're investigating the spooky thump in the night? Well, you know what? Because it wouldn't be scary if they turned on a light now, would it?
That ain't no man.
Right. Allow this average thing that's good enough to do its good enough job.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I'm not going to see it, but
I'm really into Bogul.
I'm sure you are.
I'm super into Bogul.
You're buying the early 7 inches.
He is like Pinhead level awesome, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Because he's frightening and he shows up in weird, weird places. And when he does show up, you're like, like, you don't want. It's kind of like if someone from one of those bands actually knocked on your door in the middle of the night. You know, they might be your neighbor. They might just want a cup of sugar. Like, if you lived in Oslo, that could happen. But would you still want to invite them in? No.
Why would they need a cup of sugar in the middle of the night?
For a blood sacrifice, something punch. Yeah.
All right. What else we got this week? Let's talk about Argo.
Yeah, it's your turn to say things.
Okay. So yes, based on a true story that was classified until the Clinton administration, but it actually happened back during the Carter years, right when as you will recall, in late 1979, the angry Iranians took over the American embassy in Tehran and took all the employees hostage, and the crisis lasted for, eventually it was 444 days, right?
525,600 minutes.
Shut up.
Give or take a few.
Uh-huh. Anyway, so six Americans actually walked out of the embassy while the when it was being stormed and were able to find refuge.
They didn't walk, they ran.
Well, they ran. But anyway, they basically just they left the building and found refuge at the residence of the Canadian ambassador, who hid them for quite a long time. And
several months.
Yeah. But it was becoming more and more... It was becoming more and more difficult to hide them. It was becoming clear that they were going to have to figure out a way to get them out of the country. And the CIA was trying to figure out, you know, what they could do and weighing various options. So this one agent, who is played by Ben Affleck, who also directed the movie, comes up with the seemingly harebrained scheme to create
Cockamamie,
thank you. To create a fake Canadian film production company, say that they are scouting locations in Iran, and then create false identities for the six Americans and with fake, you know, papers and everything so that they could get past the guards at the airport onto a Swiss airplane and flown to Switzerland for safety.
So and the movie was called Argo.
And the fake movie is called Argo.
A galactic conflagration.
So this movie kind of...
That's in the ad.
This movie operates on a lot of interesting levels. On the one hand, it's this sort of crazy, like, showbiz thing where they have to go to Hollywood and create a fake enough seeming production company to as a cover story for the whole thing. So they get Alan Arkin, who's this producer, and John Goodman, who's a makeup artist, and they like come up with all this stuff to make Argo seem like a real production. And then, you know, you've got this whole sort of like very, very 1970s, you know, all the president's men kind of intrigue of what's going on in the government and who thinks this, you know, they want to pull the plug on this idea because it's crazy and everyone's wearing those really ugly, heavy woolen plaids and mustaches and nicotine stains and vacuum tubes and, you know...
maroon vests.
Yeah, yeah. Just they really get the period stuff dead on. And then the whole thing of the actual mission where Affleck flies to Iran and pretends to be this Canadian movie producer and, like, you know, has to convince these terrified Americans that this plan's actually going to work and not get them shot in the street. And it's a riveting film. I mean, I liked it a lot. I love it a little less than a lot of people, I think, only because the final act has so much sort of traditional suspense moments thrown in.
Yeah.
That I...
Really well done traditional suspense
right,
moments.
Right, but the thing is that the first chunks of the movie feel so realistic as far as, I mean, not just getting the period detail right, but the conversations within the halls of the DC power structure of how these things work and the
Hall of Justice.
Exactly. And the stuff in the Hollywood stuff and how, you know, they put together these productions and we got to hire an office and we got to throw this party and put this ad in Bride. Da, da, da.
Right.
All of that felt so very true and honest that once all the suspensey stuff starts happening at the end, I'm kind of like, okay, did this really happen or are they just trying to like goose the story at this point? Like suddenly it stopped feeling almost semi-documentary and just became like a good movie, but very much like a movie where these things would happen. So the audience is like, okay, good. Oh no. You know, that part kind of took me out of it just because I felt the rest of it had been, I mean, it's the kind of movie where on the
clip. Do you know that it didn't happen that way?
I honestly don't, yeah, but I'm just saying in terms of how it read.
Why you got to get on?
Because it, like, this is the kind of movie where in the closing credits, they will show you like TV footage of the real thing right. Next to footage from the movie of how yes. They portrayed it. And it's like, they really dead on. I mean,
right.
The street demonstrations in Iran and the actual people and the, you know, just so much of the details,
the actors look like the people that actually participated in this, except for Ben Affleck.
Yeah. Like yeah. They cast, like for the six Americans, they cast people like, you know, Clea DuVall and Rory Cochran, you know, like
these character actors
who can really disguise themselves, yeah. You know, very yeah. Chameleonic, you know? And I don't know, it's a movie that I would have liked more of everything that it does. Like, there's some funny stuff, like the Hollywood stuff is funny, but yeah. It could have been funnier, and there's other parts that I thought could have been more dramatic, but overall, it's a very solid piece of work. It's a very entertaining movie. I like it a lot.
I'm just, first of all, I'm happy that a movie like this exists, because
it can still be made.
Because what it is the kind of movie that, when you and I were kids, this kind of movie was all over the place.
Right.
This kind of like adult drama,
political intrigue.
Yeah. Intelligently, you know, conceived, you know, executed without, you know, dumbing things down.
Right.
And for grown-ups, no one projectile fire hose vomits on anybody in this movie for fun. You know, there are comedic elements in the movie. But they're real. They're part of an everyday. They're part of the activity that
they're contextual and they're character based.
And so, I just like that this film exists as it does, because at this time of year we start getting these, you know, self important films,
right?
That aspire to a kind of high middle brow level of art. And maybe they hit that, and maybe they don't.
No.
But this is a film that really aspires to be just a good, solid suspense thriller based on something real, based on adult situations, based on a political situation that is not ever addressed in film unless it is highly specific and in the context of, you know, a critique of the current administration or the last administration or whatever.
I mean, yeah, obviously a movie that opens with, you know...
an explanation of what happened.
Well, right.
You know, leading up to it. Here's why they were so mad at us, you know.
Right, there's that. But what I'm saying, after you get the sort of the quick history lesson of Iran and the U.S. involvement there... To open a movie with, you know, angry protesters like storming the gates of a U.S. embassy, obviously is, you know, queasily timely in a way that they certainly wouldn't have known when they were making the film. You know?
Right.
But it underscores the what's at stake here.
Yeah, I just where I was going was the it's an educational film in a way. If you want to know where this all came from.
Right.
You know, the way things are right now, the way the world has turned, you know, particularly in the Middle East, with its relationship to the United States. This happened when you and I were kids, and this is, and we didn't understand it at the time. It just seemed like, wow, this angry country of crazy people are, you know, taking us hostage, and they're calling us the Great Satan, and we don't understand why. And the film does a really good job of, you know, giving you a quick history lesson that's also entertaining.
Right, and even though the movie sort of straddles the line in explaining why they were mad and what we had maybe done to bring their anger onto ourselves, while at the same time obviously totally empathizing with the hostages,
of course, yes.
and rescuing yes. them, you know. So it's not like
it's not like apologizing
for America crap, you know. It's not like that at all.
It's definitely on our side.
Yeah.
The movie's on the side of, hey, why are we having to hide? Why are we being taken hostage? There's no question about that. But it does provide a larger context.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a larger context. And I also like how it sort of goes just one more step further toward rehabbing the larger memory of Jimmy Carter's presidency.
Definitely.
You know, this guy who refused, with immense pressure being placed on him for military action, who kept refusing to do that, and who quietly and peacefully negotiated and quietly and peacefully conducted secret operations that weren't even known by the public until the Clinton administration.
Right.
So I'm all for this movie, you know, on all these levels. My only reservation, and it's not even really a reservation, because again, I'm happy that it exists as it exists. I wonder how Ben Affleck's career as a director will be seen in the future. You know, will he become more than a guy who's really good at making solid mainstream fare, or will he become someone we consider to be sort of a great, you know, artist? He's not at this point. He doesn't show the signs of being, you know, a Stanley Kubrick or a Godard or someone like that. Someone who's, you know, someone who's very, like, language is identifiable when you look at it or but see
he
it.
He could be a Clint Eastwood.
Right. Yes. And that would be great.
Yeah. And you know, it's worth noting.
That would be real nice.
George Clooney produced this film, and I think Clooney is having a kind of a similar path as a director himself. I think he is drawn to sort of these kind of old school, you know, straightforward dramas about, you know, topical or political subject matter. You know, I think the two of them are on very parallel tracks at the moment.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I'm wondering what that will mean in the future.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't even say that was a reservation, because it's not. It's perfectly, that's a perfectly viable way for your, you know, career filmmaking to go. Career
sure,
to go.
Yeah.
It's just not, it's not showy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make people stand up and go, oh, let's look at this new person doing this new thing that we, you know, haven't seen before.
Right.
It's like, yeah. What else? Oh, Seven Psychopaths.
Yes.
All right. To discuss the plot of this movie is to get bogged down in try it.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give it my best shot. All right. So it's
another movie that nobody's going to see this
year. It did okay. It's Martin McDonagh's follow-up to In Bruges, and
it's just fantastic.
Yeah, which is a great movie. If you haven't seen it, you should totally check it out. So this time it's set in Hollywood, and it is set in the world of filmmaking. Colin Farrell plays a boozy and blocked screenwriter named Martin, who has sold a script called Seven Psychopaths, but that's all he's got is the title, and he's trying to figure out what this movie's going to be about. And so while he is exploring fictional avenues, he is hanging around with his good friend, played by Sam Rockwell, who is a failed actor whose side gig is to kidnap pets and return them to their distraught owners for the reward money. And he does this with the help of Christopher Walken, who is more Christopher Walken here than he maybe he's ever been, ever. And then they make the mistake
of... I hear they like to be called... homos now.
They make the mistake of stealing a dog belonging to genuine psychopath Woody Harrelson, who will stop at nothing to get his beloved Shih Tzu back, and things get crazy from there. So it's a very, you know, this is a movie that gets up its own butt in a lot of ways, because it's, you know, things happen, but you're not always necessarily sure if they're happening for real or if they're happening in the script that Marty hasn't written yet. You know, the movie gives us not very interesting female characters and kills a lot of them off, but then people talk about how the problem with Martin's screenplays is that he doesn't have interesting women and he kills them off. So it's that kind of Chinese fun box, you know, Hall of Mirrors movie. But within that context, it's still pretty funny. I mean, McDonagh, I think, does a really good job, as he did in Bruges, of combining very dark humor and very, like, in-your-face violence in a way that works and is still sort of effective and funny. And the performances are fun to watch, and these guys are having a good time just sort of chewing up the scenery and each other and going kind of nuts. So, you know, if you don't mind the in-jokiness of it, you know, there's a lot to like here.
I'm actually sort of surprised that you like it as much as you do, because it does a thing that you've often described as being something you don't like.
What's that?
Well, when a movie stands in front of you and waves its arms and announces, look at what a movie I am. I'm movieing you right now, you know.
I think it's because... I get more annoyed doing that when the director, when a movie has like these big florid directorial flourishes, but at the same time we're still supposed to treat it like a movie. Whereas this is a movie that is so aggressively about being artificial and about its own moviness that, because it declares that early and often, I was okay with it.
Yeah, it declares it constantly.
Yes,
and so. And I realized another thing about myself watching it. I just don't have a level. I don't have a threshold for that. I like that almost every time. Even if the film's not so great, if you are in love with yourself and making me laugh too,
right,
and satisfying my need for extreme bloodshed, I'll forgive your other sins, like whatever they might be. And so I thought this was hilarious. I thought it was, you know, convoluted in a really delightful way where, you know, the paths are crossing, but not in a crashy sort of way.
Right.
And the anytime extreme killing is cut in half with jokes, that's a button that you can push that button on me and I'll always respond positively.
Well, I'll tell you, here's the thing. That's in that category.
If your jokes are funny.
Exactly. If you do it right, it's great. But if you do it wrong, it is unbearable.
Right.
And there, you know, I always think of those like those post-Pulp Fiction movies, like Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
No. I'm not talking about that.
Yeah.
I'm talking about when it's not terrible. Right. Yes. Yeah. Get your tone right, and you can have me. And
I like the way he shoots L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he doesn't go too sun-dappled and, you know, like, gauzy, but it's also not too grimy. Like, it feels right.
I get annoyed with the relentlessly grim Los Angeles movies. Yeah. You know, the city of Lost Angeles. You know, like, it bothers me.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, you know what? This place is great. This is a great place to live. It's not all gnarly, you know, nasty.
Cracked ends.
Yeah. Or you know, beige, dirty strip malls in Reseda.
Right. Sun-baked, you know, cracked asphalt.
Right. I mean, I guess it is for somebody.
Yeah. Strip malls with faded nail salon signs.
Yeah. I mean, but...
Yeah, that's out there, sure, but
I don't go to those places.
Yeah. they did the Californians on Saturday Night Live again last night.
Oh, did they?
And it's amazing how much of that stuff they get right. Like, they actually made a reference to, you told me about where Fountain Dead ends into that junior high school where Carol Burnett went. So somebody on that show knows the lay of the land here really well.
Fountain does dead end into that high school where Carol Burnett went. But you get around, all you got to do is turn right.
And then another left.
Another left, and then another left, and then back right, and you're back on Fountain. Yeah. And then you totally get to look at the high school where Carol Burnett went to. And you're still on Fountain.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is a great city.
I love this place. What other movies? Okay, so we were not here.
We did not do a show last week. Quick catch up.
We were in Dallas having my mom's memorial.
Yes.
We're going to catch up on the last week's five movies in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Frank and Weenie, go.
Old school Tim Burton feels like something along the lines of Beetlejuice or Ed Wood, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. That era of Burton, which I've missed. I loved it a lot. It's great to look at. A lot of fun.
Tanking because people do not want to take their children to see a movie where the family dog dies.
I guess I get that.
Yeah. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Taken two. Go.
Honestly, Taken one is magnificent. Taken two is magnificent.
Taken two... makes the first one seem like a documentary. In terms of how much it stretches logic and credulity, and you know, let's have the young daughter throw grenades all over Istanbul. Who's gonna notice?
I got bored with its. I was annoyed and bored and tired of it by the time it was over, and you know,
and the action sequences are shot terribly by that idiot Olivier Megaton, who cannot edit anything.
Live up to your name, dude.
Yes.
Deliver to me a megaton of entertainment.
And not just a bomb.
Right. The Paperboy.
Oh, man. Less than 5 minutes on The Paperboy?
Less than 1 minute on The Paperboy. Go.
Cuckoo bananas, and not always in the right way.
On a stick.
But, you know, Lee Daniels is trying to do something here.
A real sweaty stick.
Super sweaty and horny and oozy. All the fluids are in this movie.
Every dollop.
Yeah, you know, if it swims around the human body, it hits the lens in this film. Almost worth seeing with the right people, just to be like, what did I just see? But
I'm recommending it. It's awful, but you kind of have to look at it to understand that it really got made.
Yeah, it's one of the most lurid things you've ever seen in a movie theater, and with famous people doing crazy stuff.
VHS is a horror anthology that is all shot on, you know, digital,
phone cameras. Yeah, the VHS gimmick is not used at all.
That's a marketing trick to get, you know, young people obsessed with VHS tapes.
They should call the movie YouTube.
Yeah. It is the slasher movie for people who like to film socialism.
Explain that.
I don't have to. If you look, man, you're either in or you're out for both of those things.
Well, that would explain why you liked it more than I did.
I thought at least 50% of these little shorts were inventive and cool and scary and weird I'm especially into these guys who call themselves Radio Silence, who made the last bit.
It's a little
set in an old school haunted house,
right?
Yeah, it's like arms coming from the walls.
It's
stuff.
It's a little less of a crapshoot than a lot of anthology movies that come down the pike. But if you are like me, sick of POV movies of people holding cameras, that's all you get here. So be forewarned.
It's on demand too. You can get it on demand.
It is.
And Butter,
which you saw,
is the Taken 2 of aren't these conservative right-wing Midwesterners hilarious comedies? Hmm. You know, Waiting for Guffman was a long time ago. And if all you got is, oh, look, they're sculpting Butter, and oh, look, she's kind of like Sarah Palin, and oh, look, you know, they're so right-wing, and the homeschoolers, and Jesus, and I've heard those jokes 1 bajillion times. They were funny at first, I guess. But, you know.
And there are still funny ones out there.
There are still funny ones out there, but none of them are in this movie.
I got you.
Olivia Wilde is funny in this movie. She's a whore in this movie. And she's pretty funny. That's it. It sat on the shelf for a little while, deservedly so. It's terrible. Somebody's dog is barking.
Yes.
Of course. Because we now live in the land of yippy-yappy, horrible little dogs whose owners should be taken out and taken to'd, honestly.
I guess it's the equivalent of living in the neighborhood of the terrible parents who don't discipline their children.
I suppose.
Anyway, all right, that was our 5 minutes.
All right, letters. We're skipping DVDs this week. I want to catch up on more letters.
Okay.
People keep telling us things in emails. Here I go.
And we're up to August now or September?
No, dude. We're in the middle of September. We're really catching up.
Okay.
Now. Yeah. Another one from Dynamoxy.
Before we get into emails, I want to thank Cousin Boonmi for sending me a mixtape. I have not had time to go through and listen to it yet.
Well, it's for me, too. It's on both sides. One side's for you,
true.
One side's for me.
Sent us both a mixtape.
Not
so
just you.
Fine. We're sharing the mixtape.
Everyone loves me just as much as they love you.
I'm sure they do. Anyway, we have not had a chance to go through all of its bounty, but when we do, we will start using it on the show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we had no idea that people were actually going to start sending us mixtapes.
No, I didn't know that people could still do it.
Oh, yeah, of course you can still do it.
Well, I know, but you have to own the technology to do it. You know?
Yeah, it's just you can get that technology at the thrift store.
The flea market,
yes. Yeah. Okay, here's some letters.
Go. Dynamoxy.
There's another Filipino monster that, other than the Aswang, the Tiyanak.
Spell.
Tiyanak.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, that exists. and she writes, I'm currently thinking about how American Horror Story may have gained some credibility if Ryan Murphy or his writers had ever attempted to branch out into international aborted baby monsters. I really just hate the made-up word infatata. The ata part isn't a root, so adding that doesn't make the thing into a monster in any way.
It's not the thing you'd get at brunch.
It should just be an adjective that means something like infantile. That's it. That's the whole letter. Okay. I'm very happy when we just get notes. And then this is a second one from her. Okay, one more email. I live with my parents. I live in a side room adjacent to the front door. They sleep upstairs. setting my house this evening. Dad, did I detect the presence of another male last night? Me, no. Dad, really? It sounded like people were talking on the porch. Me, no. Dad, ellipsis. Me, I'm trying to think, maybe I was talking to myself? Dad, maybe Mom was? Me, oh! Okay, so there's these things called podcasts. He heard us.
Ah, okay. Yeah. We were the strangers.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
This is from Dan. Mm-hmm. Great show this week. I'll keep this brief because I'm really enjoying the top 10 lists. Alonso, I can't bear for you to feel alone in your distaste for Pulp Fiction.
Yay!
I'll screen anything else in his body of work anytime, but even the mention of Pulp Fiction gets me sleepy as I prepare to snooze through that 45-minute stretch in the middle. For a long time, I thought I was the movie's only non-fan, too. My girlfriend, also the world's most devoted Kill Bill fan, stands with me on this. Mm. And you've brought our number up to 3. Woo. Kudos. Never let anyone tell you you're the only one out there. Dave, please don't revoke my 100% knife status for this. It means a great deal to me.
See, now there's 3 of us. We will, the people united will never be defeated.
Chris Cummins sends us a top 10 list.
Okay.
Love the podcast and thought I'd write to submit my personal top 10 list. Just to make things perfectly clear, these picks are my 10 favorites, and by no means do I consider them to be the best films ever made. Your mileage may vary. Number 10, Black Belt Jones.
Okay.
Which I've never seen.
I've never seen it either, but I know by reputation.
Number 9 is one of my all-time favorites. Uh-huh. Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Oh, great.
Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains is the proto-Riot Girlinist movie that you've ever seen in
which
your life.
Also saw Madonna coming.
And, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
8, Once.
Nice.
9, Temple of Doom.
Wait, 9 or 7?
8 is Once.
Yeah.
7 is Temple of Doom.
Okay, you said 9.
Temple of Doom. Is Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous
Right,
Tank.
You said 9, Temple of Doom.
That's I don't know numbers.
Just read the thing.
Times Square.
Okay.
A sort of lesser,
fabulous,
way stains. More lesbianish, ladies and gentlemen, the right. Fabulous stains.
And lest we skip over it, Temple of Doom, still my favorite of the series.
Yeah. RoboCop.
Great.
Goodfellas.
Great.
Breaking Glass. Somebody likes his early 80s new wave ladies, doesn't he?
That Big Brother is just a...
Breaking Glass is wonderful. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, have you seen Starstruck? Just curious, Chris.
Have you?
Let us know.
Yes. This is Spinal Tap.
Sure.
Number 1, of course, The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You are 100%.
100%.
No question.
You knew that already, though, yes. Mr. Chris.
You didn't need us to tell you that.
This is from John,
mm-hmm.
who is actually a friend of ours.
Oh, okay.
In an IRL friend, not just a podcast person. Okay. Friend. I've been listening to your podcast since the summer of 2011, and I must say it keeps getting better, even though it started out pretty awesome. That's true.
Well, thanks.
Here's my list of films for your consideration. Some I know are not the greatest films, or for whatever reason, they make me all giddy inside. Danger Diabolic.
Ugh, love it.
I want to live in that lair, but with sturdier furniture. A Hard Day's Night.
Yes.
Head.
Love it.
You can't stop watching Head.
Every time
it's on TCM, you put it in the TiVo and you watch it again.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
Beautiful Thing.
Yes.
When they chase each other through the forest to Mama Cass, I cry.
Me too.
That Thing You Do.
Okay.
Well, he's a musician.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. So
I'm sure he's getting it on a whole other level than we are.
Yeah.
I saw that at the Toronto Film Festival. I liked it, but, you know, I liked it.
Little Richard.
That's a movie?
He says, this was a biopic on TV that Little Richard produced.
Oh, my God. Who played Little Richard?
I don't know. I never saw it. That would be funny to watch.
God, a Little Richard biopic produced by a still living Little Richard, I can only imagine. He probably walks on water.
Mahogany.
Great.
Yeah, he says, did people really act this way in the 1970s?
Yes, every single person.
He goes, I remember some weird stuff happening, but this is bananas.
They were all putting candle wax on themselves
yeah.
and taking pictures of supermodels in slums.
Le Mans.
Never seen Le Mans.
Cool Car and Steve McQueen, he says.
Is that the John Frankenheimer one or is that Grand Prix?
Mm.
I think Frankenheimer's Grand Prix. I think Frankenheimer's Grand Prix. Yeah. I've never seen Le Mans, but you know.
Beginners. He says this made me think of my parents a lot. They weren't gay or anything, but they got old and died. You know what? Mine too. Just recently, as a matter of fact.
Mine too. Although not all that old, as it turned out. But
and Barbarella. You know what? I bet the Little Richard movie is really terrible. I'm just going to guess that it is.
That seems possible.
So we'll give you 90%.
I think, yeah.
Mahogany's not good either, but it's a fun movie to watch.
Totally. I'm taking off a little for beginners and a little for that thing
you do. Yeah.
But yeah.
All right. 90, you're 85%. No, you're a solid B.
Okay.
B plus.
Yes.
Fine. Yeah. Matthew. Here is my top 10 in no particular order. I already know I am not 100%. I am guessing 70%.
Wow. Dare to dream, Matthew.
Yeah. Number 10, American Beauty. Well, you're well on your way to 70%. Oh, well, yeah.
No, we're off on the wrong foot here. Okay.
Number 9, A Beautiful Mind.
Wow, 70 might have been ambitious, actually.
Now, I love number 8.
Okay.
It's terrible, but boy, do I love number 8. If it's on cable, I will watch. I will sit and watch.
Is it Speed Racer?
Empire Records.
Oh. Okay.
Nothing in Empire Records is about a real record store.
No, of course not.
I worked in a few of them.
Yes.
And yet, I cannot stop watching it. And the very end, first of all, I love Liv Tyler in this movie. I love how hurt feelings she is through the whole thing. Renee Zellweger jumps up on the roof and sings that song at the end, I think she could jump off and bounce when she hits the sidewalk. Like, I'm super into that ending.
As long as I ever see another movie where Liv Tyler plays like an emotionally fragile drug addict married to a jerk.
No, whatever. Field of Dreams.
Great.
Back to the Future.
Okay.
The Great Muppet Caper.
My least favorite of the original trilogy, but still fun.
No, still great. A Bronx Tale.
Okay.
Yeah. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Sure.
Cruel Intentions. Yeah. And Little Shop of Horrors. Okay. That's number one.
Have you seen the director's cut that just came out on Blu-ray?
Where everybody dies and gets eaten by the plants
with the original dark ending.
Yeah. So you know what? I mean, technically, I guess you were 70%.
70% knife.
But I'm going to give you 5 for Empire because I know it sucks, but I love Empire Records and you're 75. 75%.
Wait. No. That means you're giving him 5 extra. You're giving him 15 for Empire Records if you make him 75% knife.
I don't know numbers.
You get a 70 for me. And you're lucky that I'm giving you Empire Records because that movie's stupid too.
Yeah, man, you're lucky.
Yeah. We should come up with like badges that people can put on their face with their knife percentage.
How much knife are you? Dear the Freewheel and Dave White and Alonzo with a Z.
Double boo.
From JM. I've been listening to the two of you for about a year now, and I'd like to thank you both for your contribution to easing my 70-minute commute to and from work each day. Wow. That's a lot of commute. I've also found some other great podcasts at your recommendation, which help pass the time. We're time wasters.
Yay!
Thanks for the tips, and I'll support Alonzo in urging your listeners to check out the programs that he plugs at the end of each show. Some more stuff that he says about... it's basically his disclaimer. Everyone's got a disclaimer before their list.
All right.
It's like, yeah, it's okay.
I'm just saying, it's not that I'm doing.
Well, here's his top 10 legit.
Okay.
Okay, he gives 2 lists.
Oh, okay.
There Will Be Blood.
His Sight and Sound list. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Harakiri.
Right.
Adaptation.
Okay.
Fitzcarraldo.
Sure.
Which he says also inspired his favorite episode of Metalocalypse. Just, thank you. The Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
Videodrome.
Mm-hmm.
Le Cercle Rouge.
No. Remember the trailers? Le Cercle Rouge.
Le Cercle Rouge. Spirited Away.
Oh, yes.
Days of Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Brazil.
Nice.
Dude, you're 100%.
Totally.
Here's his list of shame.
Okay.
The Ghost in the Darkness.
Ooh.
Awesome. Cemetery Man. I've never seen it.
I walked out of it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, you might like it, though.
Mm. A Better Tomorrow 2. And I haven't seen 2. I
didn't see 2.
Yeah. He says Chow Yun-Fat's character dies in the first movie. He comes back as the long-lost look-alike relative to avenge himself. It's like Days of Our Lives, Shattered Glass, and dead Asian gangsters everywhere. Marked for Death.
Steven Seagal?
Yes, it's terrific. God. It totally is great.
Okay.
The 13th Warrior.
Oh,
what is it with everybody
on
in the 13th Warrior?
Y'all are pulling our legs now.
You slammed another guy for having this in his top 10. And rightfully so. But this was my 13 Assassins as a child growing up. Brotherhood of the Wolf.
I didn't see that one.
Chain Whip Bone Sword is the name of my new Decapod cover band. The Fifth Element. I love Chris Tucker in this movie.
Ugh.
Operation Condor.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I love Jackie Chan movies, and this was the first one I ever saw in theaters. It's not his best, but it's one of my personal favorites. The Highlander. This dude has great taste in movies. I watched the crap out of the TV show as a kid. My closest brush with fame was when I saw Adrian Paul at the Olive Garden. Tango and Cash.
Oof.
This is the closest I've ever come to watching gay porn.
It is indeed.
We're a fan of you, JM.
I'm going to say that list was 100% linoleum.
That was definitely, yes. And here's the last one I have, and then we're done. From Rachel. Uh-huh. Hi, guys. I heard my boyfriend's top 10 movie list read out 2 weeks ago. He was the one who chose The 13th Warrior as one of his favorites, and you halved his knifeness. I laughed the whole time listening to you guys commenting on his list, so he told me to send you one of my own into you. Here it is.
Okay.
The Prestige.
Okay.
I like that movie.
It was all right.
Yeah. I don't remember a thing about it.
I remember the bird getting crushed in the cage.
Christian Bale and
the Tesla Jackman light bulbs.
Out illusion.
Exactly. This is I fool you.
Batman Begins.
Yeah.
The Mothman Prophecies.
I never saw that one.
Yeah, me neither. No. The Ninth Gate.
Roman.
I saw The Ninth Gate.
Yeah.
It is bad. It's bad.
It is rotarded.
It is bad, yeah. Hurley Burley.
Oh.
I didn't like that either.
Yeah, no.
No. One I've never heard of, and I just had to go look it up, called Mr. Frost with Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum and Kathy Baker. I vaguely remember the movie existing, but I've
never seen it. Yeah. Dead Poets Society.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't like that either. Bright Lights Big City. I'm kind of into.
Yeah, I have a soft spot for that movie. Like it exists at all is kind of ridiculous, but that's actually okay.
The Goonies, which I love, and Over the Edge, which is legitimately terrific.
I love Over the Edge.
So what is that? What do we got here? We got we're gonna give you Mothman because we've never seen it.
Yeah.
Ninth Gate, no. Hurley Burley, no. Mr. Frost.
We'll give you Mr. Frost.
We'll give you Mr. Frost. Dead Poets, no.
No.
So you're 70% here.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, Rachel. Your boyfriend emailed me earlier and said, cut her in half. Maybe he didn't tell you about this, that he'd emailed me and told you to cut you in half, but I'm outing him right now.
Well, you are stirring a pot. If they break up.
He said, you better give her 45%.
Wow, we do not want to get involved in this.
So technically, Rachel, you're 70, but we're very sorry. The bro code announces...
Leave me out of this.
You are 45%.
I am so not bro code. No. Rachel, you can keep your 70 and take that to the bank.
You two have a happy life together.
And y'all work that stuff out.
We're done.
All right. Well, you know, it's funny. I was gonna skip recommending other podcasts because we had a long show this week. But since somebody wrote in to talk about how that's been helpful, I got to
do it. We didn't have one last week. We're extra long this
week. You're right. What the heck? The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. Still waiting for that second episode of Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Malcolm. So get on with
it. Cook something, dude. Yes. Come on.
Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash with That Chris Gore, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid, who are having a get-together at JR's in Dallas. I'm sorry I'm going to miss that. I'm sure it's going to be something else. You can listen to this show on iTunes and subscribe and leave us a review. Somebody left us a review while we were on our hiatus.
Yeah, I saw that.
And we asked them
to heard it. Well, I didn't know. You had to point it out to me.
Yes. Anyway.
I didn't know we had a Twitter feed, honestly.
Well, that was weird. It just stopped in the middle of a sentence.
Is it? Are we recording
again? We're recording again, yeah.
On the same thing?
Yeah, that's so bizarre.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Well, you missed whatever we were
saying. So we got a review on iTunes, and we thank you for that. You can stream the show at Stitcher and the Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. Go to Facebook and like our page, the Linoleum Knife Podcast. Linoleum. I can't even say it sometimes.
Say it.
The Linoleum Knife Podcast. And there's even a widget there where you can stream past episodes. You can follow our Twitter account, which Dave White didn't know we had one because he's not listening to me ever when I do this part of the show, at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show at GetGlue.com, even though we're listed as a TV show for reasons unknown. And you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Send us your top 10 lists, your comments, your questions, your opinions, whatever. We want to hear from you. And please keep telling your friends about the show. That's how we get new listeners more times than anything else, is just folks recommending it. So we appreciate you spreading the word about the show. We're coming up on our second anniversary, scarily enough. But, you know, the more the merrier. We appreciate it a lot. And thank you so much for listening. We will catch you next time.
Goodbye.